Go ahead.
So, welcome to Montreal, John. It's really awesome to have you here and to have try and do these first little podcasts together and blend in physiology and clinical practice and all this interesting stuff.
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we thought that for this one, we'd talk a little bit about volume responsiveness assessment, IVC, and fluids a little bit in general. So you want to give us a little bit of the background of this stuff?
Sure. So, I think that in the early 2000s, it was there's some French groups that looked at the difference between transesophageal views of the SVC and transthoracic views of the IVC in the completely passive patient. And in that patient population, completely passive, meaning the patient's not generating any inspiratory efforts at all, they're completely adapted with the ventilator, that SVC collapse was an excellent predictor of fluid responsiveness, and IVC dilation was also an equally good predictor of fluid responsiveness. But that is very different from the patient who is generating negative intrathoracic pressure, triggering a breath on CPAP, breathing spontaneously, and seeing IVC collapse in those patients.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think those sort of ideal situations which give some more robust, reliable results, much like the flow and pressure variations that we see on the arterial side, that really only work in these sort of perfectly controlled patients. It's hard to apply them to the real world, so you have to have a bit of a different approach that is a little less simple in a way, and sometimes a little less of what people want to hear and remember. It's certainly not sort of recipe stuff with a single threshold number.
Yeah. In the days of light sedation, I don't think anyone's being paralyzed, even for ARDS, or rarely. These completely passive patients are exceptionally rare.
Yeah, very rare.
So do you want to just talk about your approach to the IVC and the patient who's generating negative intrathoracic pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge bedside ultrasound enthusiast. I approach, patients probe first, almost. I joke sometimes that, I do a little bit of history while I'm doing the ultrasound. But basically, and I like to start with the IVC because I think for me that's a good general starting point. My approach is not the one that looks for a diameter of the IVC 3 centimeters below the diaphragm, because I think that's essentially nonsensical. I think it started because you had to start with something, but I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what we're looking for is a phasic change in the volume of the IVC related to whatever's going on in the chest, be it positive, be it negative. And so since we're looking for a volumetric change, we should be at least looking for something that is looking for a volume of the IVC. And to me, that's looking at it both in long and short axis and getting an idea of what the whole, a segment of the IVC is doing with each phasic respiration, and not just a little diameter at one predetermined point.
Yeah, that physiologically that makes much more sense than just looking at it in the long axis and looking for collapse. For me, I also love bedside ultrasound. I don't think I'm as adept at it as you, Phil, but I love to look at the IVC. It's one of the first things I always do. My approach to the IVC is I approach it, volumetrically as you're saying, but I think of the determinants of its volume as being essentially a function of IVC inflow versus IVC outflow. And I look at it, and I think of it, as I've written a lot about on some of my blog posts, in terms of a Guytonian approach, as inflow as being a function of a patient's venous return, and the outflow from the IVC as being a function of the patient's cardiac pumping function. And you can get a sense of their venous return function from a volume status exam, and you can get a beautiful sense of their cardiac function from a full bedside echo.
Yeah, I think definitely you can't look at the IVC in isolation. You do have to look at it with everything else that you're going to find, both in physical and in bedside ultrasound as well. I mean, one of the things that as I do the IVC exam, I'm going to feel the belly, because I think that the intra-abdominal pressure is actually going to play in here as well. If the belly is really hard and tense and I have a really small IVC, it doesn't necessarily mean the person is dry. It could just have, you know, an abdominal compartment syndrome, and yep, the IVC can't get any bigger than it is right there. And then looking at the chest too, looking at, you know, the, if, whether it's fluid in the chest, whether it's hyperinflation, whether it's the whole clinical picture's got to be put in. And then the whether it's if it's a positive pressure ventilation, whether it's the tidal volume, or if the person is generating negative inspiratory pressure, how much are they generating? Is this someone who's like really either sedated or comatose or who knows what, but barely making any effort? Or is it someone who's like breathing hard for whatever reason that might be? And that's got to influence how I look at that collapse. You can't just say, you know, 50, 100% collapse without taking the rest of those things into consideration, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I can't agree more. It's a little bit hard to describe in a podcast format, but I do talk a lot, or I have animations for this on my website, where I try and use animated Guytonian graphics to simulate a patient who's breathing hard, inspiring hard, has a certain amount of PEEP or intra-abdominal pressure, and how those influence the volume of the IVC. Yeah, absolutely. All of those things have to be taken into consideration when you're considering collapse or a volume change of the inferior vena cava.
You're going to have to show me that, because I can't believe I've missed that and I haven't seen it. So I definitely want to look at that, because sure, it sounds like awesome animation and always useful teaching tools.
Do you want to just say what you think physiologically IVC collapse correlates with in terms of fluid responsiveness or central venous pressure? Or?
Sure. I've sort of almost taken a stand of trying to not correlate it to central venous pressure, because I'm afraid sometimes that people will try to use then that central venous pressure information as a fluid responsiveness question, and I think that's getting further away from the truth in a certain sense. I think the usefulness of CVP is in certain pathologies that you can, you really, where the pressure is actually really what you're looking for. But having said that, I use IVC very grossly. I'm not really trying to answer like, are they a little bit still volume responsive? Because I think that's actually, like I'd said in some other things, I think that's the right answer to the wrong question. I think I'll try to use the IVC to, along with everything else, to say, is my patient really dry? Are they more or less euvolemic? Or are they on the fuller side of their right-sided cardiac function curve, which I think that's really what it looks at. And then decide from there whether or not they need any fluid at all. And they may be on the dry side, but they're not in shock. They don't need fluid. And I think there's been this movement to say that if someone's fluid responsive, they should get fluid.
Yes.
And I think that's wrong, because I think humans are always designed to be fluid responsive.
Yes.
We are never physiologically not volume responsive. If we are, we're in a pathological state.
Correct.
So I'm not necessarily on the hunt for, is there still some volume responsiveness, but really just trying to broadly categorize, am I dry, euvolemic, or hypervolemic? And then depending on what my clinical goal is, which direction I want to push the patient in a little bit.
Yeah, totally. It's completely correct. I mean, when you look at the first cardiac function curves of humans that were drawn out in the 1950s, it's essentially a vertical line, meaning you should be able to receive as much fluids as possible and still your heart can pump it out of your chest. So when you're no longer fluid responsive, it's certainly something is very wrong with your physiology. For me, I always interpret the volumetric change of the IVC in conjunction with a good look at the apical floor. I really like to see what the ventricles are doing. If they look sluggish and depressed, then I need to interpret the IVC in the context of a heart that's not pumping well. So if I see a full IVC in a patient with a depressed EF, then the full IVC tends to corroborate my feeling that they are no longer fluid responsive. And if I'm making a volume status assessment, then I need to interpret that in lieu of the poor biventricular function or univentricular dysfunction, in that a patient could theoretically be hypovolemic, but because their heart function is so poor, the volume of the IVC can remain large. And so clinical context is imperative.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We really do have to look at the whole picture. I think one useful little point too about starting with the IVC that I like to do and I like to teach the residents who come around is if you take a look at the IVC and it's a big unmoving IVC, I know that unless this patient's been iatrogenically volume overloaded, we're going to find something abnormal when I next you know, twist my wrist a little bit and look at the subxiphoid. They're going to see something abnormal. It could be tamponade. It could be we can't see anything because there's tension pneumothoraces. It could be, you know, right-sided, left-sided, but there's going to be something. There's no normal situation in which this is going to happen.
Yeah, great point.
All right, I think that's a pretty good intro to IVC and fluids, and we'll catch you on the next one. Thanks a lot again, John.
Thank you.